Welcome to Ufahamu Africa, a podcast on life and politics on the African continent. I'm Kimmy Dion, one of your hosts. This week's episode features a conversation between one of our non-resident fellows, Maseke Rioba, and her guest, Jakuma Gassama. They talk about FGM, which stands for female genital mutilation. The practice is also sometimes referred to as female genital cutting, FGC, or simply female circumcision. Now, as part of their conversation, they actually talk about these different labels of the practice. And I'll just add that advocates refer to the practice as FGM rather than FGC because, as Human Rights Watch has noted, doing so identifies the practice as a human rights violation because of the violence associated with the procedure and because it is mostly carried out on young girls. Now, a few years ago, I reviewed a book by Bennington College anthropologist Miroslava Prazak titled Making the Mark, Gender, Identity, and Genital Cutting. Now, Making the Mark provides a richly detailed grassroots perspective of the procedure, not just of girls, but also of boys. So it also covers male circumcision. And it does so among the Kuria people in southern Kenya. Making the Mark points out how national bans and negative political rhetoric can have little immediate currency in local communities. Now, on remarks that were made by then Kenyan President Daniel Arap Moi, Prazak wrote in her book, despite the president's assurance that he would back any girl not wishing to be operated on, the reality of daily life made that assurance an empty gesture. And again, these are issues that are brought up in this special episode by Maseke in her conversation with Jakumba. I would recommend, you know, having a listen to their conversation, but also seeking out some of the materials that they've included in the show notes and maybe checking out Prazak's book. But before we get to their conversation, I just want to let all of you know that we have now opened up our Student Reflections essay competition for this year. So we're accepting one-page reflection essays on topics related to life and politics on the continent. And we encourage you to start by listening to an episode of your choice and use what you learn from that episode as a jumping off point to share how these ideas impact you, how the topics are connected to knowledge and ideas in the global political context, or whatever reflection you feel compelled to write about after listening to an episode. Essays are due by May 1st, 2023, and students can submit their essays independently, or if they want, they can do it as part of a class assignment. Essays should not be more than 500 words. If you have any questions, email us at ufahamuafrica@gmail.com. Winners will have the opportunity to read a portion of their essay for a future episode. Now let's go to Maseke's conversation with Jakumba Gassama.
Does cutting off the tongue reduce your appetite for food? Olabisi asks in her cross-examination in the book Unanswered Cries by Osman Conte. When Olabisi refuses circumcision, a sacred rite of passage that her mother Yapose thinks is very important, the book sets into a spiral of real-time events and factors around FGM that work towards ending it or sometimes increasing the prevalence of FGM. For me, Unanswered Cries, just like the conversation that will come out in this episode, speaks to the different cultural, social, legal, and political factors around which FGM thrives or ends. And I hope, in case you get to read the book Unanswered Cries by Osman Conte, you will pick lessons from it as much as I did. Rites of passage or human rights violations. An activist's perspective of female genital mutilation in Africa. Hello everyone, my name is Maseke Rioba, and today we discuss the rites of passage in the African continent. As a Kenyan, one of my favorite classes during social studies lessons during basic education was the concept of rites of passage. So basically, this is the transition from one phase of life to another, especially the one from childhood to adulthood. Borrowing a piece of information from Elizabeth Onyi Ezenkwe in her study on rites of passage and sustainable development in traditional Africa and the reflections for contemporary society, rites take a glaring place in the African traditional life, and it is an issue that forms the African lifestyle. Every stage of life or every activity in life has a formal procedure it takes. While rites refers to the sets of given religious activities that are usually prescribed or performed for particular activities, rites of passage are a set of such activities that are performed to mark or ritually celebrate the various stages of life of transformation in the life cycle of an individual. This cycle of life starts right from conception of a child and ends at death. People throughout the world experience and perform rites of passage in their different cultures and religions. It is not unique to Africans, but are witnessed in many religious and secular scenes. Now, this particular piece was very important for the conversation today because rites of passage in Africa vary from one culture to another, some being significant and sacred, and others genuinely being inhuman and a violation of human rights. Today, we focus on female genital mutilation in Africa. In this episode, I personally retrace the historical practices of FGM in Kuria, a minority community that is found in Kenya, and part of the people are also found in Tanzania across three generations, and I borrowed lessons from my mother and my grandmother, who are survivors of the practice, and my own experience then on how we did not at times go to the village during certain seasons where Saro, the practice of circumcision, was practiced, because then we were scared of maybe situations where children will be kidnapped and taken through the process forcefully. The barbaric practice that often leaves women scarred and with health complications is slowly being abandoned in my community. But there is still more to be done for the world and Africa at large to be free of female genital mutilation. Now, when I talk about my grandmother and my mother, I call them FGM survivors and not victims, because in the words of Jakumba Gassama, a human rights activist and FGM survivor from Senegal, a victim perhaps sometimes has succumbed to their injuries or is still helpless. But a survivor has survived the ordeal. And it was through the collective abandonment of the culture by my parents and my grandparents that made this possible. Now imagine the ripple effect if the whole village and all communities that practice FGM joined hands in saying no to FGM. Today, I am joined by a human rights advocate from Africa who is an FGM survivor, and who will be sharing her perspective on FGM as a rite of passage and her own professional journey in FGM and how we can make the world a better place.
My name is Jakumba Gassama. I am a human rights lawyer. I'm a feminist, a Pan-African from Senegal. And I'm here in Nairobi because I was attending a conference in Naivasha and then doing my work here in Nairobi with my partners.
So, FGM has been defended by traditionalists as a rite of passage. What are the historical practices that define FGM in your community? And as an activist, what is your alternative view that pushes you to advocate against FGM?
So, I think people tend to think that FGM has only one face in Africa and in the world, and it's absolutely not the case. So in my particular community, which is the Mandinka community, when you ask people, why do you do that? They can't really tell you. Mm-hmm. You have people who are telling you that it's linked to the religion, to Islam. Mm-hmm. And we know for a fact, having consulted some experts, that this is not the case. There's no hadith, there's nothing in the Quran around this. Then culturally, people will tell you that it's to prepare the woman for marriage. But then, you know, at least from the time I witnessed it, it has been done to young girls, a bit like a parallel with the male circumcision, like around the same age, 6-7 years old. And because of the amount of laws and prevention efforts that have been done, people know very well that at 6-7 years old you can tell that something happened to you.
Yes.
So they have started doing it to babies in the 90s, but if I think about my family and people that I know, they have also undergone that as a baby, just because it was convenient, because, you know, they were passing through the community when they live abroad.
Yeah.
And so the whenever people say, you know, people can't abandon it because it's part of their culture, I know that in East Africa it's really a rite of passage. In West Africa, in Senegal, in Mali and other places, some communities will tell you that it's a rite of passage too, but there's no source mm-hmm. that can show you that this is a practice that is condoned by other thing than perpetuity.
Yeah.
The fact that somebody did it to their, somebody went through it as a child and then as a mother mm-hmm. or as a parent, then will have their kids going through it just to make sure that they still belong to the community, because there's this idea that if you don't do it, then you might end up being an outcast.
Yeah, especially and, that idea of being an outcast, it cuts across all communities.
Exactly, and really it's linked to being ready for marriage at some point, being deemed fit for marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay. So, in I don't know if this is a conversation you'd be comfortable having with us,
mm.
but what was your FGM experience and how did it change your perspective on FGM as a rite of passage?
Mm.
Like, how did it change your perspective in that if you had a daughter now,
mm-hmm.
would you allow them to go through the same practice?
Mm.
So what was your experience?
I think my experience, I was one of those that was protected from this practice for a long time because my father opposed it. And was very mad when he discovered that his mother and the community of my mom and my late mom had my two older sister go through it in his absence. But I think that the level of pressure, social pressure,
mm-hmm.
That he went through, it pushed him when I was I can't remember if I was 7, 8, or 9, but in that bracket,
mm-hmm.
To have me, to give his authorization so that I would go through it. So contrary to a majority of people in my family, I vividly remember because I was older. I remember feeling very special. Because being in a family of five kids, having your mom to yourself, the grandma is there, people are preparing you, then they tell you that tomorrow morning you will go somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
It happened in the capital of Senegal, in Dakar. I remember that there was a taxi ride to some popular neighborhood.
They really did make you feel special.
Yes, because in that mentality is that okay, you're gonna go through something that is not very nice, but after that you'll be the equivalent of a woman actually.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happened is that what I can remember is that there was this huge queue. Ooh. Of adults. And of women,
mm-hmm.
and girls, more roughly my age, some a little bit younger, some a little bit older. But I remember thinking at that moment when we got into the compound of that house, because it was like in the communal space of that house,
mm-hmm.
like, you know. And I thought, this is not something good, finally. And I remember telling my mom, you know what? I think we can go.
Yeah.
Let us go. And they, of course, grabbed me. And I remember, you know, like the queue was getting shorter and shorter and shorter.
And after a while,
yes. And after a while, I could start hearing the girls screaming.
Mm.
And I don't know if it's because I worked on it, saw movies, heard other testimonies, that it's a created memory. But I tend to remember seeing the girl before me,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so the spreaded leg and people holding the legs, but from the back. So I couldn't see the lady what she was doing, but I could see that they were doing something to her and that she was screaming like that. And after that, I think I passed out.
So long.
Because I don't have memories. My next memory is to be in the bedroom of my mom in the house that we had at that time with my grandma and the baths, because you know there's some leaves and whatever, mm-hmm. so that you can heal. Yeah. And I remember that. And I remember my grandma, me telling my grandma it was hurting, and her saying that it was because of a ring she had, mm-hmm. and that this was a, and my mom told me, do you know this is a ring she never removed? It was given to her by your late grandpa, but she will remove it for you. And even with everything that happened that you don't really understand at that age, because of course nobody explains to you, I felt, you know, like, oh, this is also something special. So it's mm-hmm. a very weird situation where on the one hand you're conscious that something very weird happened, mm-hmm. but at the same time people were treating me in such a caring way that I was not used to, because the way we were raised was more like, you know, military style. Yeah. You don't do this, don't do that.
Mix two of us.
So when people are caring, mm-hmm. it was very weird. And I think for me, when people say, when you're asking what changed, I didn't have consciousness of what happened. Mm-hmm. I remember going back to school and having one boy explain, we were in a group of kids, mm-hmm. explain to the others that, you know, over the summer, they did circumcision on him. And I said, oh, me too. And everybody laughed because this was such a hidden thing.
Yeah.
And it's not all the communities in my country. And on top of it, I was growing overseas. Mm-hmm. So the people are not... were not understanding. They thought, okay, you know,
they because... they were not accustomed to the idea of a woman.
Because the young Arab boy mm-hmm. explained how he went to, I don't know, remember, Algeria, Tunisia, on vacation over the summer, and they did that to him. Maybe she's making it up. So it was like this. And, you know, at that time, Europe, even our countries, they didn't have yet laws criminalizing FGM mm-hmm. and, you know, acting on it. But... if this had happened 10 years later, of me telling at school that this happened to me, anyone who had attended, depending on the country, but for mm-hmm. instance, in Burkina Faso, the law is such that anyone who took part in the decision, in the practice, and in the caring after it, so they know, everybody who knew, knows about it, is a culprit and can go to jail.
Okay.
And so for me, the years went by, and I can't really say that, you know, there was like some huge trauma or, you know, I really went by my life mm-hmm. until I realized, and I wrote a piece about it. You can Google
yeah,
it.
Yeah, we will definitely attach a link to
it. It's FGM survivor with a master degree. And I was 26, I think, and I joined the AU, and I was told very early in my tenure as a women's rights specialist, you're going to be working on FGM.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember attending those things and conferences, working with others, and then suddenly thinking, eh? So this is what happened to me.
Yes.
So 26 years old, 17 or 18,
or even
20 years later uh-huh. that I took consciousness. And of course, with the help of those experts with whom I was working, I started realizing that this was really something that I really wanted to stop.
Oh, yes. And just a follow-up question on the aspect of decriminalization.
Mm.
But just before I go into that, I want to find to understand more, especially from a legal perspective, mm-hmm. on how decriminalization of FGM has spread out in Africa. But before I ask you that, in terms of the former practices and your what you hear about the current practices, is there anything that has changed? Because of course we cannot say that FGM has totally been wiped out. So are there things that have changed? Is the trauma slightly less? Is the hygiene better? Is there education, or is it the same barbaric act that leaves women traumatized throughout their lives?
I think there's as many stories of trauma or no trauma as there is survivors or victims of FGM. I think what has happened is that in countries where there's laws criminalizing the practice, what people have done is just to go to the neighboring country that is not criminalizing in the country, or going underground, not being so public about it. There used to be seasons of when FGM was happening, and because my community is remote to the capital, you have to cross the Gambia to reach Casamance, where I'm from, and where the majority of the Mandinka population is. And because Gambia also has Mandinkas, and we also have Mali, those people, it's easier because there's not really anyone who will come and check. Mm-hmm. And on top of it, my part of the country where the practice is high, there used to be a conflict. So it's also another layer of elements that made it difficult for the prevention and the protection of the prevention against the practice and the protection of girls. And I think what might have changed in some countries where we have seen like numbers go down at some times, it's that girls died.
Oh,
so
yes.
People then decided that it was more humane to medicalize the practice, even in communities living overseas. I've stood up against horrible practices in the US that were saying that it was like an alternative where some gynecologist or pediatrician would do just a little pinch mm-hmm. on the genitals of the girls. But even that for me is out of
it's
question.
The same thing,
it's
yes.
It's an invasion, it's a lack of respect for the bodily integrity. And I think countries like Egypt, that people don't know that it's the country with the highest prevalence rate, it might have changed.
I also did not know that.
And it might have changed, but it's really the face of FGM is the face of an Egyptian girl or woman. Mm-hmm. And they have medicalized it highly. They have doctors, high-flying doctors, who go to London, who go to everywhere where you have big Egyptian diaspora, mm-hmm. and paid very high, come and practice this on girls. So there has been a lot of attempts. The UK, I think, is one of the leaders in really trying to save, using their foreign services sometimes to drive all the way to remote place where girls have been taken, but they hold the double citizenship, they're mm-hmm. British citizens, to try and stop those and child marriage. So I would say that the practice also is so different if you look at some parts of East Africa where we have they cut the external labias mm-hmm. and the clitoris. Apparently, I heard recently and I was surprised that we also have some instances of infibulation mm-hmm. in West Africa, which means that after that they sew the genitals yeah. and leave a little hole for the periods and peeing. But this is what's happening in the Horn and the East of Africa. And for me, this is ours is already bad,
yeah.
but this one is absolutely barbaric because it's not only having the suffering at the time of the act, but carrying it out throughout
life.
Your life and the key moments of your life that as a woman become really moments of absolute dread because you know from your sisters, your aunties, that something terrible will happen
to you. And that makes me want to understand. There's something you normally say, and I think the first words that attracted me to you when I first met you was that in your professional biography, you introduce yourself as an FGM survivor. You don't introduce yourself as an FGM victim. Mm. So this word, FGM survivor, why are these words significant in your advocacy journey?
I think the survivor part is the one you want to focus on, but I think the FGM part is also important because out of political correctness, some people were starting to talk about cutting, circumcision, all those things. And I always tell people, nobody dies of cutting or circumcision.
Yes.
This is a mutilation. And I know that is very charged because people see it as coming from the West as a judgment on the practice.
Mm-hmm.
But for those of us who have gone through it, I think that we have the right to see it like this. I know that there's some other survivors who think that they prefer it called the cutting so that they don't appear as somebody who has gone, who's missing something, or you know, mutilation, people think somebody who lost a leg mm-hmm. on a landmine or something, or an arm, or people who were cut during the barbaric conflict or genocide in Rwanda or Liberia or Sierra Leone. But for me, it's very important that it remains egregious
mm-hmm.
because it is. And I think that romanticizing this is doing such a disservice, but also an indignity to those poor girls who are millions, who actually didn't make it
yes.
and died. Those are the victims for me, because they died. A victim is somebody who didn't make it.
Mm-hmm.
And for us, we are survivors because we went through something that could have killed us
mm-hmm.
and we survived. And so I think that it doesn't mean, I always say that sometimes I try not to be the one speaking, because when people see me, they think think that, oh, but this one, she has a full life and, you know, and I have a child and, now and everything. But I think it's important to tell the stories of those who are carrying the trauma and carrying the hurt in their bodies with fistula, with incontinence, with a lot of terrible consequences if it's done in certain circumstances. And so I think that everybody, it's like any identity. Mm-hmm. Everybody has the right to identify themselves the way they want. I learned that the hard way.
Yes.
So I stopped fighting on Twitter with people saying that it's cutting as long as they are survivors.
Yes.
If they want to say that, okay. But somebody who is outside of this, mm-hmm. who has not gone through it, and who is advocating to stop talking about mutilation and speak about cutting, for me, they have absolutely no say, in the same way that I wouldn't be the one saying, if you have to talk about being able differently or being living with disability.
Disabilities,
yes.
Yeah. Very true. So, collective abandonment, according to UNICEF, as a practice, refers to the coordinated decision to stop FGM. As a community, as most African communities still uphold traditional values, especially the leaders and the opinion shapers in the community. So how would you as an advocate then advocate for the community to embrace alternative rites of passage, or rather doing away with FGM totally? Hmm. How would you go about the whole idea of dealing with the conservative state of most African communities that practice FGM?
I think the way for it to work is not with global efforts are important, but we have seen countries where ministers, first ladies, you know, very influential people have decided to say no and have zero tolerance to FGM, but it still continues because anything that happens to women and girls' bodies, mm-hmm. and that is perceived as a way to keep them in the under the power of men, patriarchy, whatever you want to call it, because in a lot of culture, the FGM actually happens. There's very serious research, so that women are procuring more pleasure mm-hmm. to men, or that they don't experience pleasure, so that they can't really know, they can't really go away or be promiscuous. You know, all those excuses, but it's excuses, but it's reasons why this is perpetuated. I think that it's really where we have seen it stop. Ethiopia was a case in point. Our dear sister Bogalesh Gebre, unfortunately, has passed away, but she managed, as a survivor of FGM, to go back to her community mm-hmm. and find some different ways to mark rites of passage. There's people here in Kenya who have been doing the same.
Yes, especially in Kajiado.
Exactly. And so the problem is that, like all the issues around gender justice and sexual and reproductive health and rights, one solution doesn't fit all.
Oh, yes.
So I would tell you, for me, I'm always thinking, how can it stop in my own community?
Mm-hmm.
And when you speak to the leaders in my community is very traditional, and the leaders are all male. And when you speak to them, my uncle, who is the head of the village, he will tell me, you know, me, I have four wives. There's polygamy in our place.
Mm-hmm.
I have four wives, and I can tell you, I know what they are going through,
yes.
because we are going through it together. And this is talking about, you know, the sexual relations, the delivering babies, everything. And I would love for this to stop. It's not me who is asking them to do it. They go and they do it, and this is something, they being the women, they go and they do it, and I think that if I tell them not to do it, they will find a way to go behind my back,
yes,
and do it.
Still do it.
Exactly. Mm. So I think it's where we have seen in Mali or in Burkina, there's a beautiful movie, Molade, that shows the resistance of one woman who decides that the girls who come to her compound in mm-hmm. the village, they will be protected,
yes.
because she uses the traditional value. There's like this rule that if you put a certain thing, or if you call for a certain spirit, nobody in the village can touch you. And so people are trying to use pressure of all kinds. I don't want to spoil the movie for you.
Uh-huh.
The pressure of all kinds for her to break,
yeah.
so that she will give her daughter. And she's only doing this because she lost one daughter who died.
Oh,
and
yes.
so she doesn't want another one to
go through
and maybe die. And so There's a lot of people working on those issues, a lot of people researching. I think as long as people will think that the body of children in general and girls in particular belongs to those who raise them, we will have this this issue. I think my hope is that now that people see value in getting a girl to a certain stage in her life where she can contribute financially, economically, to the well-being of her parents and future in-laws, and you know, bring a certain change in the community, maybe they will think twice. But I admire a lot my colleagues who still work on this issue. I made a decision a few years ago, decades ago, to stop working on this because it was really breaking my heart to work on it directly. But whenever I can support the campaigns, the work of my friends on the continent, in other parts of the world where this happens, and in the diaspora, I'm always happy to be there and share.
Oh, yes. And I think, just like the first book I talked about in my introduction, another book that comes to mind when you talk about the movie in Burkina Faso is Ngugi wa Thiong'o's Things Fall Apart. When Nyambura was about to die, she was talking to Wayaki, telling him very strong words. But one thing that really stood out for me was that if Nyambura had not gone through FGM, she would not have died as a character in that book. And I think what your uncle was saying was really important. Sometimes some of these community leaders' hands are tied behind their backs. They do see the problem. They do wish to end it. But unfortunately, most of the duty bearers on board are not playing ball. So, yeah, I love that. So with your understanding of the statistical standings of FGM practices in Africa, in terms of like the community still practicing them, like how we can say Egypt is the face of all this, would you speak on the characteristics of some of these communities, and like, is there, are there things that are very similar amongst them, or is it different all across the board?
I think It like I said in the beginning, there's as many stories as there are communities, and I think maybe the similarity might be, and I really want to put it into brackets, because there are some countries where the majority of the communities of the country practice this, like Egypt, like the East African countries,
the Horn
of Africa countries in particular. East Africa, it's true that it's certain groups where they practice it. Senegal, it's also certain groups. Mali, it's a very big majority of the ethnic groups. So I think it's like for every gender justice issue, when we start to think that there's communal, for instance, some people will tell you, oh, it's the Muslims, but it's not all the time the Muslims. People will tell you, oh, it's the those who are like nomadic.
It's not like the Nubians.
Exactly. So it's like, I think we lost a lot of time in the war against FGM, trying to find one solution that fits all. I think the way I would go about it, if I was still working around that, is to try and not compromise. I think the whole idea of, oh, please, let's not impose on communities, let's not criminalize certain practices, because then, you know, you break household and you break, etc. You spoke about the criminalization. I am against the criminalization of a lot of sexual and reproductive health and rights issues, including to some extent FGM, because I prefer that we invest in preventing than waiting that the girls go through it to then put people in jail.
So more of proactive than reactive.
This is where I stand on criminalization. It's a very sensitive topic among the women's rights and the feminist community in the world and in the global south, because, you know, some people feel like those you're violating our rights should all be in jail. But I think that there's ample evidence that this doesn't work in stopping crimes against women and girls. So let's try and see what worked in some places that have similar context, that have similar resistance, but also similar goodwill, and try to apply it. But I think everybody knows, just like with child marriage, just like with rapes and sexual violence, gender-based violence. Everybody knows how, where, and when it happens in our countries. Mm-hmm. And I think if people that have the means to protect the girls in terms of the authorities, the leaders, religious, cultural, but also political, mm-hmm. if they have the courage to say, okay, we know that in September in southern Senegal, this is the time, and we go and make sure that we go to every village in numbers mm-hmm. to tell people, look, this is the law, this is what will happen if we hear that something is happening, we have a police presence, that it's not far, so that some well-wishers, brothers, sisters, others can come quickly and say, hey, listen, those people have gone to the bush, mm-hmm. things like this. Because, you know, COVID has showed us mm-hmm. that when our people really want to stop something,
they can stop it.
And this is a disease that nobody knew anything about, that nobody really had any sense of how to stop it, but they still managed to come to me.
It was for all, even the major countries, like those that we expected to be ready, and even for those of us who are not who are more developing, so if that could be sorted out, then these two can be sorted out. And sorry for cutting you short, but I love something you've said. You know, the whole idea of reactive activism and proactive activism is really important in checking ourselves with what we do, because when we react like this person has done this, let's put him in jail, we focus so much on the person who's a perpetrator, and we forget that the actual person we need to be focusing on is this little girl and preventing it from actually happening. So I do agree with you on that aspect of why don't we prevent it from happening first instead of reacting after it has already happened.
Exactly.
Because when we react, it's still continuing to happen instead of stopping. And I think this is a very important question for me, and I hope it's a comfortable topic to discuss. With your experience, would you say the global philanthropic and global solidarity movements are doing enough to end FGM in Africa? And what could they do better? And what would really need to come out clearly in this question, especially for me, is who is best fit to do something about it?
Yes. I think for every evil and problems that we have and issues that we have, the people who have the solution and know what can work for them are the people of that are affected the most directly and in the community. Mm-hmm. I would love to see FGM coming back high on the agenda of global philanthropy. I don't think it's there. I think that it has been more or less replaced by family planning and other sexual and reproductive health and rights major issues like access to safe abortion, access to comprehensive sexuality education that are also very important. Mm-hmm. But I think that if organizations of women who have decided that they want to see the practice end in their community are given the means to take the way they want. Bogalech, she had decided that she wanted to have use traditions that they have in her ethnic group and in her community around celebrating, the coming of age, celebrating certain things. And they turned it around, and it's now, I hope still, the way people are marking that time of the life of a girl instead of mutilating them. Mm-hmm. And so I'm sure there are some Bogalech in every single country. Mm-hmm. Some of them I know, some of them, unfortunately, activism on this issue against your community, against your people is not easy, have either abandoned or taken a seat back or died from trying to do it.
Yes.
And I remember in the Gambia, because we spoke about what can happen to those who try to change. I remember, and I'm sure you do too, our sisters who were put in jail and trial and sentenced by the former regime of Yahya Jammeh as if they were the biggest terrorists just because they were trying to work on ending FGM and it was seen as a bad practice.
Yes.
And there are some people that we have celebrated, and many people don't know that, but Ellen Johnson Sirleaf was one of the women who said that she preferred not to talk and work on FGM because it was a divisive issue. This is a cultural issue, and it might, in a post-conflict country, anything that can be divisive, you don't want it. Mm-hmm. Imagine, first woman president of the continent who says something like this, the impact that it has.
Yeah.
So I think that the more people will understand that as Africans, we have a lot of positive cultures mm-hmm. that can help us defeat the negative cultures. And that we have done it for a lot of things. There's a lot of things we used to do to men and boy that we don't do it. We don't do anymore. So why do we still do some things that we were doing to women at the, and girls at that, the same time that we do? Mm-hmm. And I think the last point is that, and I think it is very valid for Kenya, because the first time I heard it, it was about a Kenyan woman trying to get FGM at the adult age long time ago, and I hear now there was a case, it went all the way to court. I believe it's happening in other countries too. Some women are feeling like they want to be part of the community, that maybe this is why they are not getting married, or I don't know the reasons. I would love to discuss with them, but it's a very difficult question because we oppose it because it's imposed on people, and we believe it's a bad practice because we have evidence it kills people, it maims them, and but when an adult woman, we say our feminism is based on choice, so we respect the choice of everyone. I even tell people I would defend the choice even of a stupid choice or a choice that I don't agree with. And so I can't, as a feminist, feel good about the fact that someone who is right-minded and, you know, has decided that she wants to go through FGM for whichever reason, that, you know, it's a very difficult conversation, very difficult position to be in. And so I would love that people give more space, like you just did for me, to those women to explain to us why they want to go through this practice and what it represents to them. Because whenever somebody wants to make a choice and that we stop them, I always feel very uneasy. But I hope they understand that if they were to be allowed to do this, it will also have an impact, I think, on millions of girls. So let us find a way to also find maybe alternatives for them so that they feel that
they've been included.
They have been able to do whatever they want, because we don't know if it's that they want to be included. We don't know.
We don't
because nobody
it.
Has asked them. It makes the media and everything, the outcry, and oh, she's crazy. But nobody has, I can't find
any specific reason
that somebody asked that woman or those women, why do you want as an adult woman to go through FGM?
And I think that's one thing that's very critical. I don't want to use the word we learned recently.
Yes.
Sometimes we are very quick to make decisions or rather to make assumptions and to judge on behalf of the people.
Yeah.
But if we give them an opportunity to tell us, listen, this is why I want to go through it, then we can deal with it on that, because it's an extreme on its own.
Yes.
We can deal with it on that. So my final last question to you, it comes in like two steps. First, just a follow-up question on the solidarity. What are some of the challenges that organizations face, or activists in general, when trying to fight against FGM? And secondly, for the communities that still consider FGM as a rite of passage, because some of them look at it as a sacred ritual that they cannot abandon, what are there any proven, not really proven, but practiced alternative practices in different communities that signify the transition from adulthood to childhood? So the first question is on the challenges on organizations, and the second one is on the alternative practices that have been seen in Africa on the rite of passage that can replace FGM.
So the challenges, it's always the same. When you have the courage to stand alone, whether in a family, in a community, or in a country, you're always easily victimized, demonized, accused of serving the Western powers, or bringing anti-Senegal, anti-Mandinka, anti-whatever culture. And because you're challenging not just FGM, you're challenging the right of certain people to decide. Because even though people are quick to say, oh, this is a question of, it's the women are the one doing it, but why are they doing it? You know, and the example I gave you of my uncle is, I'm sure not the majority, there are places where the decision is enforced, or at least collaborated. And in my particular case, I told you who gave the authorization. So it's like, I think the challenges are, like, for many activists working on sexual and reproductive health and rights or bodily autonomy, that you are yourself targeted. Some of them are survivors, so you have your own trauma. And then when you fail, it's not like when you fail to get an economic policy from the Davos Forum to be at the Davos Forum to be adopted, mm-hmm. or at the UN. When you fail, there are girls that you know exactly what they will go through, and some die. This is a very difficult field to work in. For the other question around
on the alternative practices.
You know, for me, alternative practices, I told you, mm-hmm. Anything that entails touching the body in a good. Way that it's supposed to be less harmful is out. Mm-hmm. But this has been for many people the alternatives. Yeah. Also, the medicalization has been for many people the alternative. This is not the case. Where I see it, where I've seen it work, is just that people have taken the ritual of it and extracted the act of performing mutilation, or in French we say excision, mm-hmm. To cut something, or to infibulate, you know, all the acts that are physical attacks on the genitalia of the girl, they have taken it out, but they have kept all the rest. So mm-hmm. you still go to the bush, you're still with the aunties.
Exactly.
You still celebrate when you come out of the bush, etc. But instead of touching your body, mm-hmm. In some communities, they have made sure that they speak to you, they explain to you the different things. In other communities, you know, we have like the Fulanis, mm-hmm. who have like, you know, the cuts on the eyes and things like this. Mm-hmm. It's really like scarification or tattoo or things like this. Some people have tried like that.
In my community, they opted to like my grandmother's ear, they do that thing where they like elongate.
Yes. Do you know that's also
an alternative?
Yes, there's some advocates against and for it, because mm-hmm. You know, it can also have some consequences.
Yeah, it actually does.
So, you know, there's a lot of harmful traditional practices that people don't talk about as much as FGM mm-hmm. that have found an end, or at least some ways of not leaving a vacuum that would make some people feel like, you know, their culture is disappearing.
I think
the rite of passage for many centuries in all our cultures for a girl has been when she gets her period, when she gets married, when she gets a baby, which we have like biological evidence
that you've moved from one place to another.
So I don't know why we are here trying to find ways to validate mm-hmm. Something that nobody can tell you where it came from and what, and people are making up stories to justify it and ensure that the power mm-hmm. over the destinies of and bodies of girls remains in other people's hands. Yeah. So yeah.
Oh, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And now on our last question, I don't know why we always ask this question. Sometimes I feel like I'd rather ask you. What would I even ask a person at this point? I don't know. But we always have that call to action. Mm. So what is your call to action to the different stakeholders, different duty bearers? Like, what are your final words for us?
It has been the same call of action since I've decided 17 years ago, nearly, to take this issue up. It's to stop romanticizing it, to realize that this is not an issue that can accept delay tactics, mm-hmm. that the superiority complex, or, you know, the I'm losing my words in English, to look at Africans or anyone that performed those practices as children that you need to explain to calmly and, you know, step by step, the ladies who do it, you need to find them another job. I think that there's a radicality that is needed, that is required for people not to go through this, because we know the consequences. And there's even some very smart feminist economists who have quantified mm-hmm. the price of FGM and child marriage, yes. The consequences on the next generation and on the country, mm-hmm. what as on the community, on the country, on the family. So I think that the evidence is there. Everything
More
is there.
Enough.
It's all about people being serious. And it's like the difference between listening and hearing. Mm-hmm. Let's ask everyone who has a role to play on this, ending those harmful practices in general, and FGM in particular, to hear and yes. to make sure that those within those communities who have the will and the solutions mm-hmm. have all the means to achieve success.
Oh. Thank you. I feel like I have picked so much, and I hope to all of you that are listening to this particular session, it's been entirely enlightening for you. For me, what was really important about this conversation was gaining experience, or rather learning, picking a few lessons from somebody who's experienced in it. And I believe in my own way, I have picked a few lessons, and I hope even for those of you who are listening, you can realize that sometimes practices that represented rites of passage in the African continent are an abuse of human rights, and as such requires to adapt to totally doing away with them to ensure that we do not cause harm to the parties against whom these actions are being performed against. Looking forward to seeing you next time, and bye from us.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Ufahamu Africa. You can find more episodes, show notes, and transcripts on our website, ufahamuafrica.com. This podcast is produced and managed by Megan DeMint, with help from production assistants Chukwufunanya Ikechukwu, Alex Kozak, and Ami Tamaklo. Our non-resident podcast fellows are Bamba Njaye, Maseke Rioba, Takona Priscilla Sempere, and Kamohelo Tuniko Toledi. We are generously supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York and receive research assistance from Cornell University and the University of California, Riverside. Our music is courtesy of Kevin McLeod. Until next week, Safiri Salama.